Good morning, diners and travelers.
You sounded like you were asleep there for a second.
I was almost.
Nodding off.
Yeah. But anyhow, you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and I hope that everybody's passed the chocolate shock for Valentine's Day.
Yeah, we hope so, don't we?
Yeah, what's our next big holiday?
Next, I don't know. I mean, we're going to London coming up soon. That's a big holiday for us.
Yeah, we're usually there at Valentine's Day.
Yeah, I know.
This will be the first time in, what, 7 years? We're going to Valentine's Day lunch?
Probably longer than that, but the difficulty is, aside from this bad wing that I have right here that's being recuperated right now, which means we maybe couldn't go. February 14th also fell in the middle of half-term school holidays,
which is a nightmare.
When London's very busy, so we decided to move our stay to a little bit later in the year. And the nice part about it is, by the time we get there in March, more of the flowers will be out. London, it will be spring in London, and it'll still be snowing in the Berg, so we'll be able to rejoice in the fact that we're not there.
Have you seen what they're doing in the Balkans? I mean, they're having to dig tunnels to get out of the great blocks of
snow. It's not good at all, but that's not the reason for today's program.
Yeah.
We're not complaining about the weather. We're here to bring you some really fascinating characters who have added to the world of food lore with excellent cookbooks on a variety of different subjects, and we're delighted to bring them to you today. And who's up first, dear?
First up is everybody loves Ed Levine, and he, of course, came from a print background, but then he left that world and moved to new media with the site called Serious Eats,
which is sort of self-explanatory, but you'll know even more how
he's
serious
so much
it is.
Fun.
He is, but he's also very serious. So here's Ed.
Ed Levine, we were just reminiscing that I had worried about him when he gave up the security of his nice New York Times post and leapt into the internet for this online site called Serious Eats, and now it's, how would you describe it? It's iconic as a food site, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a place. I regard it as a digital clubhouse for people who are passionate about food gather. I've always imagined it as a clubhouse where food enthusiasts would gather and talk about their latest discoveries or ask questions or find a recipe for prime rib that they can serve for the holidays.
You know, that's coming back.
And of course, what's so great about the internet is we have infinite capacity. And so it enables us to do whatever we want and to experiment in whatever media that we want to experiment, and it can all be part of Serious Eats. And of course, that's really exciting to me as someone who's created content in radio and television and books and magazines and newspapers. I don't have to worry about those distinctions. Well, the only thing I want to know is, are we helping people make better decisions so that they can eat more seriously delicious food, whether it's cooking a great dish or finding the best taco in the country or whatever it is. I've always wanted more people to eat more seriously delicious food. So,
yeah, what was it? No, you called the missionary of the delicious.
Yes, right. That's right. Ruth Weichel called me the missionary of delicious, and in a New York Times article now quite some years ago, but what she captured is what I hope we do on the site. And of course, that was well before Serious Eats existed, and that we are missionaries. We want to tell you about the food we love, why we love it, who made it, and why you should care about it all.
Now, the core of this, Ed, is a website with a blog and all that stuff.
It's a family of blogs. It's a website. I'm not sure I've ever understood the distinction.
That's fine. Well, what's the website, first of all?
www.seriouseats.com.
Right. Okay. Now, this, though, is a cookbook, and more than a cookbook, actually, because it tells you where to eat and what to eat and so forth. So, is it the first cookbook you've released?
Well, it's the first Serious Eats book. And I've written cookbooks with chefs, Tom Douglas.
This is the first
Serious Eats book. And so what we want, of course, the hard part is, how do you translate a website or a family of blogs into a book?
I was going to come to that next. I mean, they're sort of about as different as oil and water. They probably don't mix too well.
But here's what's similar.
Go ahead.
And this is what I wanted. I wanted people to feel the same energy that they feel when they get to the site. And that's harder to do in a book because it's not interactive. But I think we've accomplished our goal. It's also something that's visceral that you can pick up in your hand and sit in a chair without staring at a screen. And yet I think it's a logical outgrowth or manifestation of the site because we're still telling you where to eat and what to cook and how to cook something seriously delicious. And we're just doing it in a different form. Still, in the end, text and photos.
Yeah, but you even have a section called How to Use This Book.
Right.
And you say, read it for fun. Read it to discover how we approach the world of food, how we've learned to spot the true gems, and what we've learned about the stories behind them. Read it to see how others eat across the country. Read it to learn how to make 50 of our favorite foods, and read it to understand what drives some of the greatest chefs and sandwich makers and farmers in the nation. And all that is true, but I'd like to add another one. I visited this book, and it was like attending a party with a lot of old friends.
Yes. Well, I take that as the highest compliment that someone can pay the book, because that's where the energy comes in. And I want you, to the extent that it can be a clubhouse, I've always imagined Serious Eats to be the world's biggest food lovers cocktail party. And in one corner, you'll have people discussing pancakes, and in the next, you'll have them discussing the pros and cons of eating lunch at the French Laundry, and it's all of a piece. And so if you hold it in your hands and you think you're now at a party, that's about the best thing that anyone's said about the book yet. Because that's exactly how we feel, how we want people to feel when they arrive at the site. So if we can do that, if we can convert that energy into book form, then I think we've accomplished our goal.
Your chapters really cover all the major food groups. Breakfast, burgers, pizza, sandwiches, hot dogs, and more, barbecue, fried food, street food, sweets and bakery, homegrown and house-made, and then more. Do you know what I can't remember? Did you recommend the best Reuben sandwich in the country?
Did in the book. Actually, I really like the Reuben at Zingerman's.
Well, that's one of the major contenders. Yeah, I went to Ann Arbor to school.
Yeah, there are three on one page, and Zingerman's was the one I recognized.
Yeah.
The
other part of actually writing the book that was so much fun was, yes, we went to places that I knew about, and Zingerman's is hardly a Serious Eats discovery.
Yeah.
But for every Zingerman's that's in the book, there's a pizzeria in San Antonio that most people have probably never heard of outside San Antonio, called Dough. And it's funny, when Jeffrey Steingarten called me to congratulate me about the book, he said, okay, let's get on a plane to San Antonio. So I said, why are we going to San Antonio, dude? He said, to eat pizza dough. Sounded so good.
That's really playing with words well, when you can get someone together on a plane and go a thousand miles for a piece of pizza.
And I think what the book has also done is what we've tried to do on a site is we think you can be both passionate and discerning. I think what's in the book is both passionate and discerning, and I think almost everything on the site is passionate and discerning. We're not boosters for the food business. We don't work for the Chamber of Commerce of San Antonio. But on the other hand, if we discover three great places to eat in San Antonio, we're damn sure going to tell you about it.
Well, you found them in Pittsburgh, which was sort of amazing.
Right, yeah. Well, it's funny because our New York editor, Carrie Jones, who is, I call her the straw boss for the book, because, the book was written with, and this was something I'd never done before, as a collaboration with all the editors on staff at the time. And Carrie Jones, who really was responsible for making sure that everyone's copy was in and when it was supposed to, her boyfriend is from Pittsburgh, so she went to Pittsburgh two or three times in the course of the writing of the book. So
Yeah, you found Tesoro's. You know, that's not really a place that I know.
Yeah, again, we were steered by a third-generation Pittsburgher.
Uh-huh. Well, that's it. That's the kind of inside.
Yeah, you could have asked Anne. She would have given me the same. She would have given me the same information.
That, again, that is how we attack the food culture. Is we didn't settle for the tried and true. We didn't. It's not to say you won't find some places in the book that, oh yeah, I've heard of that. You know.
Yeah.
You're going to get that, but I would be shocked if you or anyone else who is knowledgeable about food knew more than 30 or 40% of the places in the book.
Oh, sure. Yeah. There's no question about that. Because how would one person manage to get to all these places?
Right.
I mean, the secret was you had a team.
Yep. And we had a team, and the key was, believe it or not, last September, when we were at the tail end of writing the book, JetBlue announced one of their all-you-can-jet promotions. So I don't know if you all remember this or if Pittsburgh is even a JetBlue town, but they run this promotion. They didn't run it this year. For $499, you can go anywhere on the JetBlue system in the month of September.
So you did that, huh?
So we did that. I did that. I bought passes for four of the editors as well. So they were, at the drop of a hat, flying to Portland, Oregon to eat Andy Ricker's chicken wings or whatever, and then the next day they'd be in Seattle eating Tom Douglas's house-made English muffin breakfast sandwich.
Funny part about it is there are a disproportionate number of restaurants featured in your book that are in Portland, Maine, and Portland, Oregon.
Right, it's true. People could accuse us of having a pan-Portland bias.
Yeah,
maybe there's a Portland in another state we don't even know about.
You know the story that you know how Portland got its name.
No.
It was almost called Boston.
Yeah, that's funny.
There were two guys who were out there in what was then called Stumptown.
Right.
And they decided they would flip a coin because they couldn't agree on which one would get to name the city after the city they came from.
Got it.
And one of them was from Boston, the other was from Portland, Maine, and they won. So that's how Portland got its name, but Portland, Maine hasn't given up either. And it's got a wonderful identity in food we discovered just last year when we went there for the first time.
Yeah, it's great.
So there are places that have traditions like that, and it's wonderful that you highlight those in this book.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's really what we were...
You know, you gave a lot of ink to food truck scene. I mean,
yes.
What do you think is happening or is going to happen with the food truck scene?
Well, there's a natural evolution, you know. Used to be that food trucks were the exclusive province of first-generation immigrants. Then what happened was young chefs who sort of bridled at the idea of spending 10 years apprenticing in kitchens before they get to open their own restaurant quickly figured out that they could open a food truck for far less money than it would take to actually open a restaurant. So now you have two strands of street food, right? You've got the immigrants, and then you've got the sort of chefy.
Right. I love
the term
chefy.
And you get some crossover, but I think it's great. It's something that allows for more people to cook their own food. You have to work in a restaurant for a long time to cook your own food. So with a food truck, you can cook your own food immediately.
Yeah, we got that. Did you get that Mission Street Food book? Yeah, it's cool, isn't it?
Yeah, my friend John T. Edge is writing a street food book.
Is he really?
Uh-huh.
From what city?
Well, it's all over the country. It's got a lot of recipes. And so it's,
I wonder when he's doing that.
I mean, he's in Oxford, Mississippi. But
yeah, I know.
But,
I think it's coming out either this spring or next fall.
Now
I wonder why he'd be interested in that.
Oh, he loves street. You know, John T. is, we share many passions. And, you know, I think at one point John T. had his own hot dog cart on the square in Oxford.
Well, we've interviewed him. We love him, too. He's really full of surprises, but I didn't know about this book.
Mustn't forget to mention this book also has recipes for how you can make some of these things now.
Rigorously tested, you know. These are not casually tossed off recipes.
But one of your team made up the
recipes.
Yes,
Kenji Lopez-Alt, our food lab columnist, who is actually writing his own book for...
Oh, so you didn't get the recipes from the restaurants that you featured?
We would have a meeting and we'd say, I'd say, this is what I look for on Korean fried chicken. And then he'd have us up to his apartment, five or six of us, and he would have made 5 or 10 versions of Korean fried chicken. And it was like, okay, so if we mix this with this, we should end up in a pretty good place. So the recipes are actually very carefully written and obsessively researched.
And I'm guessing that that's probably the only way you could go anyway, because Zingerman sure as hell isn't going to give you their recipe.
They did. It's like that. Kenji has too many ideas, and we have so many ideas, even those of us who are not serious home cooks, that just didn't make sense to use somebody else's recipes. We do so many recipes of our own on the site. So
right. So listeners, this is a gang that you need to get involved with. If you're serious about exploring food.
There's a little quiz that you can tell.
Oh, there is a little quiz? Oh, you can?
As a serious eater.
Oh, yes, yes. The back cover has the Serious Eats quiz, so you can discern whether you're a serious eater.
Yeah, well, I didn't have to go down very far to realize that I fit that category. But anyhow, I wish you well, Ed, on the
walk. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and continued success with your website.
Any news you'd like to break? No, you know, we're constantly doing new stuff, and so we're curating food video playlists for YouTube, and
we
also have some Serious Eats original video content. And great thing about Serious Eats for me is that it's a canvas that will never be filled up.
That's true. All you have to do is wake up and have a new idea. And
exactly.
All of a sudden, you got five more years' work to do.
Absolutely.
That's my kind of a job. I
exactly.
love it.
My kind, too.
Well, Ed, we'll hope that we'll see you soon. We'll
run Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
We'll run into you somewhere, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
And if not, happy eating.
Thank you, and you too.
Thanks,
Ed.
Bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be back in a flash. 16 seconds to be exact.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station. www.aspstation.net.
And back we are with another culinary star, Virginia Willis, who has a long list of culinary accomplishments and experiences, which we'll talk a little bit about, and we'll focus in on her new book, which is charmingly called Basic to Brilliant, Y'all. Virginia Willis's Basic to Brilliant, Y'all, is exactly that. And it's 150 refined Southern recipes and ways to dress them up for company, which is the Basic to Brilliant. How about that? Welcome, Virginia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, you couldn't make it easier for her. I mean, you're known for making your directions very clear, for being an excellent teacher. So I guess it's not surprising that this is a very usable and welcome book.
Thank you very much. I have learned from great people on how to write recipes and make them clear for the everyday home cook, and so I do pride myself on that. Thank you for noticing.
Oh, well, you know, it's not an easy thing to do.
There's a lot of very good explanatory material too here for people who are not from the South, really don't know much about the South. I enjoyed your story about the Georgia cowboy.
yes, Will Harris. He's fantastic.
Who said he was sending his meat off to be fattened was like sending your daughter off to the whorehouse.
Right. He's a salty character. He's a true treasure, American treasure, not the Southern treasure.
Well, I guess we've become more familiarized with the South, never had been before. Well, a couple of things. Our son and daughter-in-law and their family, they live in Greenwood, South Carolina now, so they've absorbed a lot of stuff, and we spend time there. And then we've always been involved with Charleston Food and Wine Festival, and we know all the people from there. Certainly has come a long way, hasn't it? Southern food.
Well, I think so, and I think that there's a couple of different things. And, you know, first of all, my book is predominantly Southern. I am predominantly Southern, but
you're I've French been able, trained.
Right, French trained, and I've lived and worked and traveled a great deal. I think that one of the things that I like to consider the most about Southern food is that it doesn't have to be trapped in the past. And I've tried to share that with this new book.
Well, see, this is what, just talking to our chef who wrote the Moroccan cookbook, and he said that in Morocco, if you're doing traditional, things never change. You eat the same thing every single year, year after year after year, and he doesn't think that food should be that way, that it should not be static, it should be evolving. And you're trying to do that too.
Yes. And we have a lot of really great product to work with in the South, and there still are places that one can get very traditional food, and there's still some of the food can be very traditional in the home, but it's changed, it's evolved. There used to be these huge, huge breakfasts when people worked on the farm and were up at daybreak, and the lunches were bigger, that's what we call dinner. Those were really big, and obviously because of modern day, that's changed a bit. So I think that it's most interesting when cuisine sort of moves and evolves and changes.
You were getting sort of homesick when you were working in New York just before 9/11. What kinds of things were you missing? I mean, we've interviewed the Lee brothers many times, and of course their whole business, everything started because they missed the boiled peanuts.
Right. Well, when I worked for Martha Stewart, every Friday, especially if it was a long sort of arduous week of taping, every Friday I would get in the kitchen and make biscuits and grits for my kitchen team for breakfast on Friday to sort of wrap the week on a just positive note. You know, anything's available in New York City, pretty much.
Sure.
I mean, almost anything. Any time, day or night, and you can practically get it delivered. So it was really more of, I guess, slowness, a calmness, sensibility, obviously friends and family. Even in the cities in the South, I mean, nothing is like New York. We all know that. But I guess I was just became increasingly homesick.
But where did you get this brilliant idea? I mean, it really is a brilliant idea, and you keep on saying it's brilliant all the way through the book. Anyway, in case we missed it.
I'm very thorough with it, right? I wanted it. My first book, Bon Appetit, Y'all, was very well received. It's done very well. It's resonated with a lot of people. People are treating it's like the little Energizer Bunny. It just keeps going and going. For my first book, it's been quite successful. So when it came time to consider writing a second book, I wanted to build on the success of that. I wanted to continue sharing the seven recipes and the seven treatment and sort of my refined Southern cooking with my French influences. I wanted it to be more like if the two of you were to come over to my house for dinner, I might be a bit more inclined to do the brilliant version of the recipes. So I wanted to show people sort of how to think like a chef, yet without using expensive and hard-to-find ingredients, and without necessarily dumbing things down.
Can you give us a couple of good examples? What do you think are good examples?
Yeah, I think that one of the ones that's possibly the most simple is the recipe for the kale omelet.
Oh, I love that.
Thank you. The winter greens, collards, kale, mustard greens, turnip greens, all of those winter greens are staples in the Southern diet, or traditionally are staples in the Southern diet in the fall and in the winter, because they grow well here in the fall and in the winter.
But, you know, all of a sudden, kale is the hero vegetable.
It is the hero vegetable.
I grew up on it.
I love it. So in my recipe in the book, the basic is to have an omelet, and it's a flat-style tortilla omelet, not a folded French omelet, but it's a flat, very simple dish to execute for breakfast for a couple, you know, gathering family and friends on a weekend or when you have guests over or company. And then the brilliant version of that is literally just as simple as taking a round loaf of bread, a boule, and cutting out the center and baking the omelet in the center of the bread. And it's just, as you see in the photograph, it's just beautiful.
It is.
And it looked very elegant, sophisticated, special, restaurant quality, and yet it's just as simple as carving out a hole in a loaf of bread. So I think that's one of possibly, it's a great example of my execution of basic to brilliant.
Yeah, well, what about the bouillabaisse? It's even more simple. You took your basic bouillabaisse and added fennel.
Yes. Well, I love that recipe because that recipe, you know, every sort of culture under the sun that has a coast has their version of a seafood stew. The Italians have theirs, the French have theirs, there are different seafood stews in Asia, etc. So my recipe for bouillabaisse is, the basic is actually a combination of a low country boil and a French style bouillabaisse, because I've added the potatoes and the corn and the sausage, which isn't traditionally in a French bouillabaisse, but is in a low country boil. And the brilliant for that is exactly adding a bit of sauteed fennel. It's just, sometimes it's just that little thing that takes it to something being more chef-inspired.
Right, and the whole book is this. I mean, you go through everything, and you manage to figure out a way of elevating something you could use on a casual basis, weekly, weeknight meals,
right,
into something with comfort. So now, what are some of the things that you particularly like to work with, since you have a very sophisticated French background, too?
Oh, it depends really, thank you, it depends really on the time of the year. Last night, I had been traveling for a week on book tour, and I wanted roast chicken. I just wanted something as simple as I possibly could get, and so I came home and made that. But this time of year, when it's colder, I do love making braised meat and soups and stews and things like that, but I love the technical part of it. I mean, just put a bunch of meat in a pan with vegetables and top it off with water, then pass it for, like, thin and fitted. Not going to be, but if you take the time to sear the meat, cut the vegetables, saute the vegetables in the residual fat, and if it's done properly, it can be really quite delicious.
Yeah, well, Peter likes your dobe.
Yeah.
Well, I like dobe.
He's an expert dobe maker.
I like dobe recipes generally, although I'm in the middle of a feud between Amanda Hesser and Willen.
Ah, that's quite the place to be, sir.
The question is whether you sear the meat first or not. And actually, Amanda Hesser has recipe both ways in her recent New York Times classic cookbook. But Ann Willen's my favorite because she just says put the meat on the bottom and then layer the vegetables on top and then fill the bowl up with red wine and leave for a couple of days. I like that better. That's a lot easier.
But when after she takes it out, does her recipe say to sear it?
No. You just leave it in the pot.
Huh.
You put the meat in the bottom, and then you put the different layers of vegetables. She even says what order you're supposed to layer them in.
Right. Well, my French training is from Ann Willen.
Yeah, right.
When I was there, when I sort of arrived as this one would say, a freshman with Ann Willen, mm-hmm. Amanda Hesser was a sophomore, stagiaire to Ann Willen, immediately before I was.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was quite an education then, but you knew how to cook before you even got there. Is mem a French term for grandmother?
No, ma'am. It is, but it's not, that's not why I say it. My pronunciation for my grandmother is Mimi.
Mimi.
M-E-M-E. I couldn't say grandmother, or I think my other cousins called her grandmother, and I couldn't say it, so it somehow became Mimi, and it just stuck.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, they're the funniest of these grandmothers. I'm just a nana, you know. But the funniest is this whole troop of kids that call this woman I know Mama Hot.
Mama Hot. That's
because,
great.
Well, every time they go near a stove, she'd say, hot.
Oh, that's so cute.
So, I mean, she's really quite sort of, I don't know how to describe her without being insulted, but she does not look like a hot mama.
But I love that, Mama Hot.
Mama Hot. Right.
I had a big mama. I knew a big mama in my life. I was pronounced Mimi, and my grandfather, who was also very important to me growing up.
Yes, you said.
We called him Dee Dee. So Mimi and Dee
Dee. Dee Dee, okay. Well, this Louisiana duck gumbo is pretty extraordinary, too.
It's really fantastic because we moved to Louisiana.
I want this right now.
Oh, it's delicious. We moved to Louisiana when I was 3. And my mother, I just recently realized this. My mother didn't know anyone. And I think to acclimate herself to her new surroundings and to meet people, she bought the local cookbooks and started cooking the local food.
Oh.
And therefore, I grew up eating etouffee and gumbo and all of those things, all of the Cajun and Creole dishes. And even though it wasn't that long ago, the early 70s, that was really different. There wasn't as much, say, Cajun and Creole in Georgia in the 70s. This was really exotic stuff for me when I was a little girl. I had certainly never seen that before. But we grew up eating it. And that Louisiana gumbo, duck gumbo, is delicious.
It looks fabulous. So, and are you in Atlanta now, you said?
Yes.
So hurry on over tonight to the Woodfire Grill, is it called?
Yes.
That's where they're having the Moroccan dinner. So jump on over there.
Ah, nice.
Take a break from not cooking.
She's having leftover chicken tonight.
Yeah, I'm actually excited. I'm going to go to an event with a book club, and the ladies in the book club are cooking dishes for my book, and so that's what we're having for supper.
Oh, that's great.
So I get to taste my food created by someone else, which is always really... Really neat and satisfying.
Be able to figure out how brilliant it is.
Yes, exactly.
You know, I was trying to figure out what this was with watermelon floating in it. That's unusual, isn't it?
It's like a little pickle. That dish, that's the brilliant version.
That goes
with the pork belly. And that, oddly, even though it's one of the least expensive cuts of meat, that actually is a bit... is one of the more restaurant, sort of high-quality restaurant dishes there. But the pork belly, of course, is so rich.
Peter loves it. It's a little rich for me.
It's very rich. So to counteract that richness, I thought about a pickle, and a watermelon pickle is very traditional Southern, although we normally pickle it in...
The rind. My grandmother pickled the rind.
Right, and so this is something a bit fresher. It's more of a brined... pickle with garlic and some chili, so to really sort of reach through the richness of that pork belly.
Well, all of your recipes, and this whole entire book, Virginia Willis, are so thoughtful. So make a note, listeners, rush out and get Basic to Brilliant, y'all. Did I do that all right, Virginia?
Yes, I think you did.
You've been spending too much time in Greenwood, South Carolina.
I know.
Well, thank you again, and I hope the book tour goes really well for you.
Thank you so much for having me, y'all.
And On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig will continue after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, we're back, but I'm going to turn over to Ann to introduce the next interview.
Oh, yeah, one of our favorite guests, Melissa Clark, who's a prolific writer, and she does also a column for the New York Times dining section, and we've interviewed her on other books, but her current one is Cook It Now, or is it Cook Now? We'll let her tell us about it. It's been quite some time since we talked to Melissa Clark, although I read her columns in the New York Times faithfully. And it's not that she hasn't had a whole bunch of cookbooks in between when we talked to her about her cookbook, Skinny, which gave me a complex for 3 years.
Oh, no.
Do you still fit into your size 2 black dress?
Well, since I had my baby, maybe I'm a 4.
Yeah. So the answer is, the short answer is no.
Anyhow, so you've come out with a new book, which is getting all kinds of rave reviews, called Cook This Now, 120 Easy and Delectable Dishes You Can't Wait to Make. Well, it's certainly interesting. You've organized this not just seasonally, which we come to expect anymore, but you go month by month. And you also do month by month through farmers markets. We're not cheating and going into the supermarket for this either. Did you have fun doing this?
Oh, well, I mean, that is exactly how I cook and how I live my life. You know, I'm lucky enough to live walking distance from a farmers market in Brooklyn, and I go with my family every weekend. And, you know, the way that this book was created was I go every Saturday, I buy a bunch of stuff, I bring it home, I put it in the fridge, and then, pretty much just like everybody else, at 6 o'clock, I say, oh, no, what am I going to make for dinner? And I open the fridge, and what do I have? I have seasonal food that I've gotten from the farmer's market, and then I figure out what to do with it.
Well, you didn't figure out what to do with the pig's trotters, I noticed.
Yeah, I gave up on those. But most of the things I figured out. Well, I actually did figure out what to do with them. I figured out that I just had to throw them away.
Yes. I've never seen him. I've bought pig straws. I've never seen him with dirty toenails. I mean, that was really disgusting.
Yeah, that was one of my less good investments. Luckily, they were only $1 each.
So. Oh, well, Peter almost never married me because I treated him to pig's trotters in red sauce served with spinach noodles.
Oh my goodness, that sounds good.
It was awful. Absolutely.
I wasn't as adventurous an eater then as I have now become.
Yeah.
It still wasn't good looking.
Yeah, well, you know, spinach noodles are hard.
Let's talk about the structure. We talked a little bit about the structure, but and we'll go through it in a minute. But in addition to the seasonal month by month, what's in the farmer's market and how to cook it with the recipes, you also have sections called what else? And also sections called by any other name.
Mm-hmm.
What are those?
Well, the what else section is, so what else can I do? You know, it's all those other things that roll around in my brain when I think about a recipe. So ingredient substitutions, if you don't have, for example, I don't know, if you don't have or you don't like cilantro, you could use mint or you could use parsley in this particular recipe. Or if you don't have chicken stock, you could use water mixed with a little bit of salt and pepper. You know, there's different ways to substitute things. And I just talk about as many of them as I can think of because I think it's helpful for people. Or maybe I'll talk about timing on a recipe, how you can do something in advance. Just general hints and tips specific to that recipe. And then the A Dish by Another Name, that's a variation section. So whenever I can do variations with pretty much the same recipe, just a simple variation, I'll write it up there. And that way people get a lot more recipes. You know, it's 120 recipes, but really it's a lot more.
And then what about, how did you select these already published recipes that you added to the back?
Well, those were published in my last cookbook. And they were, the last cookbook, that one was a hard, that one was called In the Kitchen with a Good Appetite. And that one,
right.
It's 150 recipes. 50 of them were recipes from the Times and 100 of them were brand new. But the problem was that because 50 of them were from the Times, the assumption was that all of the recipes were from the Times. And so that was a problem because a lot of them were new and people didn't realize it. So what I did was I took some of my favorite recipes from that book that had never been published in the Times, and none of the recipes in the new books have been in the Times either. Cook This Now, all the recipes are, you know, brand new, nothing published before. And I put them in the book because I felt like they got lost in the last one, and I wanted them to come. I wanted them to have another life.
Oh, that's interesting. I like this roasted eggplant with basil, green goddess dressing.
Yes,
it pushes all the buttons.
I love roasted eggplant. And I love Green Goddess, and they just seem to go together so well.
Yes. Let's just play a little game. I'll pick a month, and you tell me what you find in the farmer's market and what a good recipe is for the ingredients.
And why don't you start with December, since December's probably slimmest pickings in the farmer's market anyway.
And
December's not nearly as bad as February. By February and March, you're getting desperate. But since we're in the month of December, we can do December.
Okay.
So, well, December, you know, you're still getting lovely greens in December. You know, December is the perfect time to do things like Brussels sprouts and hearty kales. I love to find the last of the winter squash. You can still find pumpkins and acorn squash. You know, by the time January, February rolls around, those have pretty much lost all their sweetness. So this is December's a really good time to find things like that. Root vegetables are fantastic in December. You know, root vegetables get really good after a freeze. They get really sweet, like turnips and rutabagas and parsnips. You can also still find broccoli rabe in December. Again, you know, another leafy green that, you know, we're going to start losing those as the freeze comes and freezes really hard. So this is a good time for all of those things.
Well, you're lucky you have a farmer's market that stays open in January and February. Ours close.
I know. A lot of people say that, and I am very lucky. Even though there's not a lot there, what there is there is good eating.
How about February? Let's do February.
Cabbage. By February, it's cabbage, potatoes, and onions.
And but how do you make that into a Valentine's feast?
There's also, you can still buy chocolate. Chocolate is always in season. And celery root is another thing that keeps very well. And, you know, I'm not strict in this book. It's seasonal in its organization. And it's spirit, but it's also not strict at all. I'm not a locavore. I don't ever think I could be a locavore. I eat the foods that I want to eat. I just try to eat them in season because seasonal food tastes better.
Well, I think that these recipes are really accessible. In fact, the whole book, I think, should be noted as very accessible.
Oh, good.
And usable.
The thing about the recipes are, as I was saying, they were kind of the meals that I made at 6 o'clock when I said, okay, what am I going to make for dinner? You know, they were the impromptu meals. They were the easy meals that I made with the stuff I had around. I think every day all of us have that, we face that question, you know, what am I going to make for dinner? And so you see, this is what I made for dinner last year, but only the good ones. I left out the bad ones. It's all the good stuff I made last year.
Yeah, and you're also in Brooklyn. Now, that has to be a treat. How changed Brooklyn is. How long have you lived there?
My whole life.
Oh, wow. I mean,
yeah.
Aren't you just flabbergasted?
Yes, constantly.
Now, let's ask the really tough question. What are you cooking tonight?
That's a really good question. Well, I was just in my kitchen, and I was like, I have this delicata squash that I really do need to use. It's got one little soft spot on it. I got it at the farmer's market a couple of weeks ago, and it's begging to be used. So I was thinking about how to do that. I think I'll roast it with a little bit of honey and a little bit of cayenne and some sea salt and olive oil, very simply. And then, you know, leftovers. I love to give leftovers a new life. So we have, I roasted a duck a few days ago, and I've got leftover duck. So I was thinking of maybe I would make that into a pasta sauce. So, you know, we eat a lot of whole wheat pasta, so I would probably do maybe some spinach I don't think I have spinach, though. Maybe something green. I think I might have Swiss chard. So some duck pasta with Swiss chard and whole wheat pasta, and then the spaghetti, and then the delicata squash. And, if I can do a salad with that, I will. My daughter actually, she's 3 and she loves salad, so I'm going with it.
Yeah,
I don't know how long it's going to last.
Well, our grandkids love salad too. I was really, since they're both picky eaters, I was really surprised. They like cucumbers and tomatoes.
Oh yeah, Dahlia loves cucumbers and tomatoes too. And it's not cucumber season, but you know what? If she wants a cucumber, I'm going to give it to her.
Now, maybe you can explain to me, this is a very interesting recipe here for raw kale salad with anchovy date dressing.
Yes, I love raw kale. Raw kale is one of those newer discoveries for me. You know, I've been eating kale for years, but only a couple of years ago was I introduced to raw kale. And it's, people think kale is very tough, and it can be, but you just slice it very thin. And when you slice it thinly and you put the dressing on, it softens it. And it really just has such a fresh green flavor. I just love it. And the good thing is that it stands up to a very hearty, intense dressing. Now, this date dressing, it has citrus, it has anchovy, it has garlic. It's got a lot going on.
Oh, I like the sound of it, yeah.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's really wonderful, but it's intense. And if the second you put it on a soft screen like arugula, you have about a 10-minute window to eat that salad. And after that, it just falls apart. You know, the weight of the dressing is too much for the greens, but not kale. Kale can stand up to it. You can make the kale salad, and you have a couple of hours.
Now, why is it all of a sudden it's like somebody discovered kale? You get kale, you get it cooked raw, you get chips.
Yeah, I know. It's funny, isn't it? Yeah, we are really, we've always had kale, but we're really broadening our kale horizons lately. Maybe because it's so good for you. You know, the more we learn about kale, the more we realize that this is really good to eat. I mean, it's got anti-cancer enzymes in it. It's got, it lowers cholesterol. I mean, there's a lot that kale does that's good for the body.
Now, what are your favorite ingredients? What else? For August, you have tomatoes, of course.
Yeah, tomatoes and cucumbers. Oh, I love summer. Summer is such a bountiful time. Melons are fantastic in the summer, in August and July. You know, you have cantaloupe and watermelon. Oh, I want those now. Of course, corn. August is really, really the beginning of the best corn. You know, we have corn. We'll get corn as early as June, but in August, it's just so sweet and wonderful.
Yeah, you like corn a lot. I see your corn salad with tomatoes, avocados, and lime cilantro dressing.
Yes, that is a good. That is kind of a classic at our house. I do a corn salad like that. I really like the sweetness of the corn with the tartness of the lime juice, and then you've got the creamy avocado. I just think it's a terrific combination. So I'll do that a lot.
Well, I must say that I think that our tastes probably run the same because you like the ingredients I like.
Oh, good.
How about you, Abbott?
Well, that's handy, lovely, because when you're cooking up a storm, you can be cooking from Melissa's cookbook, and it'll be fine. And then you'll have an excuse for putting off trying to decide what to have for dinner until 6 o'clock.
And then if you do a recipe for my book, it'll be on the table by 6:30. For the most part, they're very fast recipes.
Okay, that sounds wonderful. I need some fast recipes. Tonight I got a slow recipe. I know it's a long recipe, but that's just the way. Well, I have to make my tomato sauce to go with the hake, and it doesn't matter how long it takes.
how long you think you can speed it up. It still takes an hour to cook.
But
it's worth all the trouble.
That's okay. Start it now. And
well, I already picked the parsley and the fennel fronds out of the garden.
Oh, good. How nice to be able to do that.
Yeah, well, we still have some.
Won't be for much longer,
no.
But we still have some.
And we even had broccoli the other day.
Yeah, the parsley's not growing anymore, but there are still some leaves on it.
That are green.
And
yeah.
I think the fennel's pretty much done, I think, as well.
I think arugula's finished.
It's not sprouting anymore. But, I mean, it's December. What are you going to do today?
Yeah.
Today I bought snow melt in anticipation of the first of the season. So
yeah.
At least if we get an unexpected snowfall, I'm ready.
Right.
And Melissa, what gives you your ideas for your New York Times columns?
You know, I get inspired by everything. I always start from a place of hunger. You know, I start with, what do I want to eat? And I think that's a very important place to start when you're the cook, because if you're not making something that's going to please you first, it's probably not going to come out that well. So start with, you know, what are you hungry for? And I start with, what am I hungry for? And then I think, okay, well, what will my kid eat? What will my husband eat? And what do I have in the fridge? And, you know, by the time you get done with all that, there's often not that many choices.
And that's a column every week that you do.
Right.
Okay. I don't see the New York Times and follows it, of course, every day.
So, but this Wednesday is the big food dining section.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
One of the comments I want to say is you clearly love garlic.
Yes. I do. Garlic, anchovies, strong flavors. I really love strong flavors.
Yeah. And you had a, what was it? A Tuscan kale recipe with the same dressing that the Romans used for Punterella. The anchovies, right?
Garlic, yep.
Isn't that in here? I thought I saw that in here.
Might be.
You forget. You're working on to your next book now?
I know, exactly. I'm actually working on Punterella for the next book. So I'm.
Are you really?
Yeah, I'm working on a book, a wonderful restaurant in my neighborhood in Brooklyn called Franny's.
Oh, yes.
And they do a Punterella salad.
Where do they get the Punterella?
You can get it in New York. I don't think it's local.
It's not the same.
Is that Frankie Sputino, those guys?
No.
No, that's a different one.
Okay.
They do Punterella, too.
Yeah, well, I mean, who was it? I can't remember, but he's in the Far East. And I said, where did you get Punterella? He had a Punterella salad.
Oh, it's funny.
She had it shipped in from Hudson, Ohio.
Yeah, somewhere. But the
Farmer
stuff
Jones.
You get in the States, I don't think it's the same thing.
But Farmer Jones can grow anything as long as you're prepared to pay the price.
Yeah.
Well, Melissa, I hope you do really well with this book.
Oh, well, thank you, Anne.
Yeah, again, it's called Cook This Now, and the author is Melissa Clark. And also, make sure you read her columns and get great ideas for recipes each week in the New York Times. Melissa, delightful to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to both of you.
Thanks.
Now we'll take another short break, but don't go away because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are. And our next guest is not probably as well known as the other people we've interviewed for this program, but the book surely must become well known and on everybody's shelf. I mean, it's so beautiful. It's beautiful in spirit. It's beautiful physically. And it's called, the name itself is beautiful, Rose Petal Jam. We have a physician who also is a cookbook author, cook, Beata Satorska, and along with her husband, Simon Target, produced this book called Rose Petal Jam, Recipes and Stories from a Summer in Poland that is absolutely knock your sock off beautiful. Congratulations to you, Beata.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your compliment.
Well, your story is a bit complicated. You were born in Poland and endured a number of uprootings in your childhood as a result of the war and the Cold War and the USSR. But through all this, you had some really strong, wonderful characters in your family that produce beauty in all kinds of ways, including in food. Is that a summation?
Yes, that's correct. I think my great-grandparents and grandparents kept lots of Polish tradition no matter where they lived. They were born in Lwów, which is now Ukraine, and it was part of Poland before the war. And after the war, where their borders moved west, they also had to move west, and they were resettled, a part of Poland that used to be Germany. And because they were resettled back in 1945, where they were moved to a big mountain farmhouse, the German family was still living there, waiting for their repatriation to Germany. So my grandparents, I think, lived always among people of different nations and different religions. And yet they kept their Polish tradition, yet I felt they were always very accepting of other nations as well. That sort of gave me a background of living in Australia, where I live among different nationalities, and my friends come from all sorts of backgrounds, Greek, Italian, Chinese, French. And I think that was just the beginning of sort of 21st century style of living. Yet my great-grandparents were born back in 19th century. Yet the Polish tradition in the family survived, and no matter where we live, we love Polish food and Polish Christmas tradition and Polish Easter and all the and we love cooking Polish food.
Well, your opening paragraph says, "It was my job, aged 5, to gather rose petals to make jam. Each day, yes, together with the local bees, I carefully inspected the deep green wild rose bushes around the house to search for any newly opened buds. I had to be patient and wait for the June sun to assert itself and the mountain winds to stop howling at the fragile early summer days. Finally, one magic morning, a bush would wake up from its green sleep and large pink flowers would greet the rising sun." You're a beautiful writer.
Thank you. I love writing. Writing is like meditation to me. And I think when I migrated to Australia, I wrote a little bit of poetry in Polish, but I now love writing in English. And I felt I wanted to write a book about Poland in English for my family and for my new friends, so people will learn more about Poland and more people will be able to learn about the beautiful country I've left 30 years ago.
Now, when you were writing this, you were in Poland?
No. In Australia. I've lived in Australia now for 30 years.
No, I thought so. I was just...
Away for 20 years when her husband presented her with tickets to Poland.
Yes. I think the book is like a sweet dream for me, like remembering childhood sounds and tastes, and it's just part of me, that childhood in a little mountainous village in Poland.
And yes, and you have a picture. You were absolutely adorable. A little chubby there.
With all those pierogies.
But no, I mean, you were writing about your childhood in Poland because you spent a great deal of time with your grandmother, who was actually a chef, right?
Yes, she was a chef. She was a teacher before the war, but after the war, because of all sorts of political problems and my great-grandfather's strong anti-communist views, the family was forced to different type of jobs. But my grandmother, as it happened, was a very good chef, and she, I think, learned a lot of cooking when she was a teenager. And she loved her job. She put all her heart into cooking, and she loved cooking for others and entertaining. So the way the family survived the Cold War was through my grandmother's cooking for a local, like a holiday resort, and people loved her cooking, and I think she was given lots of nice produce, and she could cook and pour her heart into it.
And your aunt, apparently, also was a chef, so she knew enough to save all the recipes for you.
Yes. So my grandmother's son, who's my uncle, he married Sabina, and Sabina also loved cooking, and I feel she learned a lot from my grandmother. I think they had a wonderful relationship. So she's the one now who's in her 70s that absolutely can cook like my grandmother. Maybe she won't listen to it. Maybe not as good.
Uh-huh.
No one can match my grandmother, but she thinks she is the one who keeps the recipe. And I decided to write them down because I feel we'll all forget what she used to make.
I thought you said that she kept the recipes. You meant she kept the memory of the recipes because none of my ancestors.
No, she kept the recipes. No, we have a book of recipes. And those recipes are really on a sort of old brown paper. And they come also from Julia, so my grandmother's mother. And there is some writing that comes from someone else as well. So I feel they really come from the end of the 19th century. When my great-great-grandparents migrated from Ukraine back in 1945, and you could just take few possession before you were put on a cattle train, really, and put and taken away from the part of place where you were born. My grandmother would take her recipe book. I felt it was like taking the family, in a way, taking family photographs, and that was important to her, for her to take as well. Yes.
We know an American chef who's of Italian descent had similar experience, born in the
She was born in what was then part of Italy called Istria, which became part of Yugoslavia in 1948 or 1949. There was a dispute that ran from 1945 to like 1948 or maybe 1950, and all the people who wanted to be Italians had to leave and migrate west across the border in just the same way as your ancestors did. And it was a very distressing part of what was happening in war-torn or post-war-torn Europe. So you experienced it firsthand, and she has, and the wonderful part about it is that you both extracted from that experience something that's of real value that traces you back to where you originally came from. Who knows, maybe one day you'll be able to go back there.
Well, she has been back.
But I mean, to the Ukraine, not to...
Ukraine, yes. I have a great hope for Europe. I feel the borders were moving through centuries back and left and right, and people were fighting, and I hope that if the Europe is more united and the borders are more open, people will naturally mix and visit the places where they once lived. I'm a great believer in friendship on the country borders now. The great thing happened in the area where I was born, which is now that German part of Poland. There was a city called Skorzelec or Gerlitz, where the film The Reader was filmed. And that's a German Polish city, which you never believe, that has high schools and schools that teach both Polish and German, and people are bilingual. And I believe they sort of example how European borders can be very peaceful and nice places to live, because I think there's just such bloody and tragic history in Europe, because countries are so small and the borders are moving. Now that I live in Australia, in this vast country with just very few people on the coast, it's very hard to understand that people would quarrel about, you know, few meters of land.
Right.
But I think it's just so important for the history, and people's sort of attitude to borders and countries would change, and I hope Europe will be like that one day, one open space like Australia.
And maybe your book will help. Did you ever think about that?
Yes, I would help, just why included in it the story of the German doctor, which in a way inspired me to be a doctor.
I was going to ask you if that was your inspiration for being a doctor. I read the story about the German doctor who was so kind to the Polish people.
Oh, yes. There was the one person that stayed behind in the village, and I believe his family and children left. And I'm really not quite sure why he stayed, but when all the new Polish refugees were arriving, he was the only doctor in a vast area, and he was treating Polish people coming back from the war with the injuries, so, you know, psychological problems. I can't imagine what people were like back in 1945, you know, malnourished, displaced. My grandmother was widowed, and he was very kind. My grandmother could never forget how kind he was, and not speaking Polish to anyone, and learning to speak Polish, and not charging people, and showed so much kindness to everyone. I always felt I couldn't reconcile it as a child, how a German person could be a good person. I remember, and you know, obviously, it was a very good lesson that you never judge people by their religion or nationality. You judge people for who they are, and I think this was a great lesson.
Well, this is a great tribute to people and to place as well. You have architecture in here, beautiful architecture, Polish architecture, and the famous musicians, and you have you poets and print. in both English and in Polish. And then the photographs that your husband did are just amazing. He must use a lot of filters. They're beautifully romantic. And then the food, though, is so sharp.
And we photographed, I think we took about 60 or more thousand of photographs, so it's very hard to select them. And we have had a very good book designer, Miranda Harvey from London, and she's the person who could choose the photos, because each time she would reject a photo, I would cry, because I could not decide. I said, you must have this photo, you must. It's a little bit like with the editor of the book who cut lots of pages and lots of stories, and each time I would cry, but I'm really very grateful, because the book has to be understood by the readers, and every book needs editing.
Oh, well, it's a beautiful story, well edited, well produced. And now, did you modify these recipes much, or did you update them?
A little bit, because some of them, as you can imagine, they even start with making your own butter or something.
Oh, sure.
I wouldn't go that far.
I was looking at the donuts with rose petal jam, which sort of symbolizes the remembrance of the book, and they sound fabulous.
Yes, they're quite difficult. Again, anything with the yeast is quite difficult, especially I made all recipes at least 3 times.
Oh, my.
Myself to test them and retest them, and trying to remember how my grandmother used to make them, and it looked so easy. I remember popping those donuts, popping up and, you know, being fished out and being so delicious hot. But it only looked easy when you watch someone else making it.
Uh-huh.
But I couldn't write a Polish cookbook without those donuts, because they're such an intrinsic part of Polish cooking. And those donuts were so special, and especially because that's the food where you use the rose petal jam for. You can try to put different jams into donuts, but nothing tastes like the rose petal jam in
it. Tell me, how do you make this rose petal jam? You said you got
It's really just putting the rose petal in the mortar with lots of sugar and grinding it and making very thick paste. And that was all to it. There's no cooking involved, no thickness, no citric acid, because I have Polish people now ringing me, telling me that's how you make it. My grandmother used to do that.
Really?
But my grandmother used to do it just like that. And I feel because the roses were wild, they have incredible taste and flavor.
Yeah, and no insecticides, pesticides, none of that.
Yes, I can still smell it, and truly when I was picking the flowers, I remember that rose oil was on my fingers forever. And I love all the rose perfumes now. I have collection of rose perfumes in my home, and just nothing comes close to it. I love rose water in Lebanese cooking.
Obsessed
with taste of roses. I think I could eat roses from the vase.
Well, again, congratulations on this magnificent book. And I really hope that it gets a lot of acclaim, and that people acquire it for so many reasons. And you were such a cute little thing.
I know, it's Miranda, the designer, who insisted on the childhood photos. I was a little bit reluctant, I find them a bit personal, but he said, no, if you write a book, it has to be personal, people have to relate to you. So I decided to put the photographs when I look fatter than the pierogi.
But you look very happy.
Yes, very happy child.
Well, congratulations, Beata, and also
Thank
to
you.
Simon. And
Thank you.
Yes, and it was wonderful talking to you.
Thank
and
you.
I think it's amazing that you are also a practicing physician with all this writing talent.
So all you Polish listeners, you better line up and buy a copy of this.
Oh,
so
yeah.
You have no excuse. You have every reason to read the stories, because many of them will be like your own. But more importantly, grandmother passed away without passing on the secrets. You'll have them all over again.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye.
And if you don't have misty eyes after that wonderful story, then there's nothing. There's no help for you. Thank you so much to this author for a beautiful story. And that's all we have time for this week. We'll see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.